the MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire.
Hello and welcome to this week's episode of ExchangeWire's MadTech Podcast. My name's Anne-Marie Sheedy, CRO at ExchangeWire, and today I'm delighted to be joined by Lisa Goodchild, Chief Troublemaker at DigiLearning Foundation and the DigiWoo Digital Agency. Hello, Lisa.
Hello, and thank you for having me.
Absolute pleasure. I'm also thrilled to be joined by a voice that you're probably more than familiar with, Rachel Smith, CEO of ExchangeWire. Hi, Rachel.
Hello. Sorry, everyone, for the overfamiliarity of my voice. Maybe I'll just start adopting a special voice and people won't know who it is.
You could use one of those machines, couldn't
you? Yeah, exactly. Voice distorter. Great idea.
Then we'd never know who's on the podcast. So we've got a couple of interesting stories as usual this week, and I'm going to kick off with our first one, which is about eBay, the online auction site, announcing the purchase of Known Origin, which describes itself as one of the world's first and largest NFT marketplaces. eBay started allowing NFT sales on its site last year. And with the Known Origin acquisition, eBay has the opportunity to control a proper digital marketplace where NFT transactions can be both monitored and controlled. This week also saw Meta join with brands such as Balenciaga, I think it is. Balenciaga. I'm not really
Balenciaga.
Into my...
Balenciaga.
Balenciaga.
Yeah. Oh, that's it.
Not one of my regular purchases, I'm afraid. And Prada, which I can pronounce, but also don't buy. Anyway, the offer closed for digital avatars. So, ladies, I'm going to come to you first, Lisa, if that's all right. I'm keen to kind of get your thoughts on whether or not you feel this is a sign that the digital and physical retail worlds are colliding.
I think we've been seeing that for quite some time now. And especially, interestingly enough, I started off my career in e-commerce back in the day when nobody was going to buy online. And, you know, we were like getting orders and Ted Baker and Mothercare to start. It was their first introduction of selling online. And it was really interesting times. And I think it's a natural progression, actually. And now you can see that digital has taken over the high street. You know, I remember going into businesses and being like, you know, there's one shop in Bromley High Street, or there's one shop where the world can reach it. How many people are walking down Bromley High Street? You know, so it is, I think it's a natural progression. I don't think it's going to be as fast as what ones would like it. Because as we've seen with augmented reality, you know, it's taken many years for it to slowly progress. And even as we've seen with things like QR codes, they only found their way during COVID. Mm. They weren't, you know, I had a QR code on my business card for years, like 10 years ago. I think it wasn't it like 1993 or so? It was years ago, a QR yep. code. Was created, and actually it's only now that they found their footing. I think a company like eBay taking this route is obviously going to accelerate that process. And also it's the simplicity, isn't it? It's the simplicity for a user journey. You know, earlier my school mums asked whether we was going to chip in for the parents present, and normally I just completely forget because it's not easy, but it was two clicks, and two clicks enabled me to go yeah. And I can imagine, you know, seeing a cool piece of art by something, but or you know, or even a, you know, the musicians, everyone's going into the NFT space because it does protect you as a creator. And I think it's exciting what we will see on eBay. And obviously the young people, they love this. You know, we work with our young people at DigiLearning, and they're all over this space. They're already purchasing these non-fungible NFTs. They're already using them as well. And then you can trade them, can't you? So you can go in and trade them in the shop for a physical item. So it's very clever marketing. I think done in the right way, it could be really cool. But I think it's exciting times, especially that eBay's made that move.
What are your thoughts, Rachel? Are you all over your NFTs?
Yep. That's exactly what I'm doing, trading and swapping my NFTs every opportunity I get. Yeah, I mean, I think Lisa raises some really good points. I love your opener there that, you know, you started in e-commerce when nobody was ever going to buy anything online. And I can remember even having conversations with friends as little as probably, I'm going to say maybe 5 years ago, when I was explaining that I was doing pretty much all of my clothes shopping online and it was a 50-50 split. You know, some were like, yeah, me too. And others were like, no way. And I'm never going to do that. I'm always going to want to go into store. So I think you're right, Lisa, of the acceleration of trends, digital trends that are inevitable. And those of us that feel like it's a little bit shocking just haven't been caught up in the wave yet, either because we're not in that particular age group or in that vertical or interested specifically in these things. That doesn't mean that it's not going to continue to be enormously popular and grow and accelerate. I do agree with you that I think eBay getting into this space is just is an indicator of that. It's, you know, I'm not saying they're making the most of an emerging trend, and they're wanting to get involved in it and get ahead of it. I thought it was quite interesting that, you know, and obviously it's logical, I guess, that to start with, these transactions, these NFTs are being sold on eBay using regular currency. But, you know, at some point they did make mention that they expect there to be the use of cryptocurrencies and blockchain technology in order to facilitate that. So that's kind of really interesting, because that's exactly where I expect that sort of online payment space to start moving. And you can see that with a few sort of digital payment disruptors who are not just trying to disrupt the traditional payment infrastructure, but they're also trying to disrupt banking, and they've often got a lot of interest in cryptocurrencies, never mind what's happening with cryptocurrencies in the stock market at the moment. That's a whole separate conversation. But the other thing I thought from this news story, especially as, you know, it was rightly tied to Meta's announcement of partnerships with high-end fashion labels and the ability to be able to purchase those fashion brand items for your digital personality and your avatar, is that this is also it is principally, I think, an example of following where they think the money is going to go, right? So, you know, social media platforms like Meta are, in my opinion, always not struggling, because they're obviously doing very well, but they're always moving around trying to find ways to monetize their platform. And this is another logical progression of that. They know that customizing avatars and making them as personalized and real as possible is a huge trend. As you mentioned, Lisa, it's exactly what young people are all over. In addition to NFTs, you know, young people have been playing games online with avatars that they feel extremely sort of attached to for a long time. So the idea that they could then attach that to high-end fashion, create what is commonplace in high-end fashion, which is this feeling of wanting to follow the trend, not wanting to miss out. Once they do that and create some exclusivity around it, then you've got demand, and that they could potentially be making money out of that. As for the fashion brands, though, I find it quite interesting, because they're still not physically selling something. And so I'm interested to understand things like price points and, you know, how that actually happens, and who's actually buying those things, and what kind of, you know, yeah, how much money it's costing them, right? Because kids can't all be decking out their avatars in Balenciaga and Prada, because presumably those brands are going to want to protect their high price points, their sort of exclusive, brand presence in some way.
It's interesting, because there's been a whole virtual, I think it was a couple of months ago, a virtual or metaverse fashion week, where I suppose it's interesting. What, you know, is it another data player? They're giving it access to the masses. Whereas previously I would have thought, again, it's not something that I'm particularly interested, so I haven't explored it. But I haven't tried to get a ticket to go to London Fashion Week or Paris Fashion Week. But I would imagine I'd be fairly low down the list anyway if it was open to Joe Bloggs. But I reckon it's pretty difficult. But if I'm really into fashion and I want to have access, I think it's pretty exciting for a young person or of any age to be able to kind of go into this world and see what's happening. And even buy, it may not be, I think it was whatever brand it was, I probably couldn't pronounce it anyway if I did remember it. It was their, like, a previous season. It wasn't their latest. It was maybe a season before that they could buy certain items. But then other brands were making some of their latest items more available. And I thought it was kind of, wow, this is smart. They're getting that engagement. It's that kind of aspirational stuff that they're tapping into at a young age, like the kind of Porsche makers of the world or the Rolex watches, et cetera, used to have, or the Tagores did previously, advertising to audience at a young age. So that when they do earn X amount of money, that's kind of top of their list. But also what I found interesting from the eBay's kind of their current NFT sales method comes with some caveats, of course, such as, like, there's again, not my problem, $10,000 maximum buy. I can get over that.
Those Dolce & Gabbanas that sold for 5.7 then million, we wouldn't be able to get those on there. That's...
I'm not sure my Nike high tops, my canvas Nike high tops will get there. And I don't think I'm in any fear of finding some collectible cards to put into that massive facility that they built. I think it's a 31,000 square foot facility called the eBay Vault, which is to house all these kind of graded trading cards that have a value of over $750. And they're kind of saying, is this the future of physical collectibles of all kinds? But you can get it, but you can't go to this vault. And then, of course, this then triggers another question in terms of what's it doing to the environment? Mm-hmm. How much energy is all this using? Mm-hmm. How much, you know, all these transactions that are going, all this trading? I don't know, but that's a pretty big discussion that we're...
I suppose people have been doing it with cars, though. You know, there's billionaires and millionaires. They collect these cars, keep them in the basement.
That's it. That's it. And they don't necessarily sit. They're either not used at all because they don't have time to use them, or they buy them for the specific purpose of potentially investment, and they garage them until they're ready to sell them on. You know, like that's not an uncommon thing to do. And I guess that is also what happens in the world of high-end art. Maybe even wine, like it's not purchased to drink or to consume, even if it's to lay down for 10 years. The whole idea is you lay it down, make money on it, and sell it again. So I guess this is an extrapolation of that. And you can see how, you know, I think what we're also seeing applied here is the basic economics of a digital world, that those that are selling things in a digital landscape think to myself, well, my audience is potentially infinite. So this is great for me. I just wonder where the demand comes from. And there is demand, I know that, but I just wonder what that looks like and how as a brand you continue to create that demand, particularly if you're a high-end luxury brand. Yeah.
But what about bringing it to the masses? This is my concern. It's this exclusivity or, you know, high net individuals. Why is it always in at the top level? Why can't we create something that's accessible to all and allowing access to this world, or at least the opportunity and the understanding of NFTs, without having to have a shed load of cash that you've got your hands on somehow that allows you to buy these cards or whatever it is? Because I can't see Primark, who have just started trading online. I don't think you can buy. I don't think they'll deliver to you. I think you can just click and collect. Because I mean, that would be their margins out the window. And I'm not advocating buying from Primark either. But I just think it's an accessible clothing range also, without getting into the throwaway name.
They're not as bad as what people think. There was a big research piece into them, and actually their sustainability, what they do with their employees in comparison to bigger brands that, you know, are charging a lot more, they're actually quite there. But it's very concerning, you know, like you're saying, putting that high-end mark on things, and these young people especially aspiring to this.
Yeah.
It is concerning. And it is a trend in the world. And I think there was a report recently about young people being exposed to social media, and 50% of them felt negativity when they came off of social media. And 90% of them, no, sorry, it was the other way. 90% felt negativity, 50% wanted to get plastic surgery.
I mean, that's shocking, really, isn't it? It's utterly shocking. But it totally makes sense. I mean, part of that whole feeling of inferiority because I'm not fashionable enough or I'm not attractive enough or whatever it might be comes from exposure to others that you perceive to be more fashionable, more attractive, etc. So in a digital world, you've got, again, infinite exposure to images, to social media profiles. And so that kind of makes sense. And that is definitely the dark side of it. But the other side, the idea that we could democratize access to things that have otherwise been exclusive. I like that side of it a lot. And I like the idea, and that's what appeals to me about disruptors in any industry, really. So that element of it, I find really interesting and really exciting. It'll be fascinating to see where that goes with respect to NFTs and with respect to, frankly, anything that's happening in the metaverse as well.
Yeah, I agree.
Kind of moving on from there with the money makes the world go round angle, going on to the next story, which is about more companies are launching premium tiers. Again, what's this going to look like in terms of access? But in particular, this is both Telegram and Snapchat. And it's a story about how they're working on adding premium tiers to their services. Telegram's top tier will improve speeds and allow for extra large file sends, while Snapchat's Snap Plus service offers early access to new features. And a quote from the founder of Telegram, Pavel Turov, said, "After giving it some thought, we realized that the only way to let our most demanding fans get more while keeping our existing features free is to make those raised limits a paid option." So with that in mind, Rachel, I'm keen to come to you first on this one. I'm going to go, well, is this subscription model sustainable?
So I think this is very much a story about monetization models, subscription versus ad funded or subscription alongside ad funded. I think it's hilarious that, as you would be familiar with AMS here at Exchange, while we're big Telegram users, that's our main messaging company messaging app. So I am a Telegram user and I like it a lot. But it's hilarious that Pavel describes us as fans. I'm not sure. I don't know. Like, is he sort of channeling Steve Jobs there and trying to kind of with a bit of an Apple exclusivity play, or I'm not sure what it is. But despite how much I enjoy using Telegram and how much I might be a inverted commas fan, I am not going to be paying for a subscription service to a messaging platform. Why would I do that? It's interesting what they're trying to offer to incentivize people to do it. The whole idea of large file sharing and different formats. I can understand if the functionality of Telegram is smooth enough, and it is pretty good. I enjoy the functionality of Telegram. I find it a lot more applicable in a business environment as well than WhatsApp or other messaging platforms. So if that's smooth enough, then yes, you might pay for that if it's an easy way to share large files. But even then, I'd be looking at that in comparison to whatever else you might subscribe to, whatever other document sharing and filing document and file sharing services you might subscribe to. I don't think it's ever going to represent a huge amount of revenue for them. And so then I think we come to a place where we'd be looking at exactly how many people are paying for subscription access and how are you otherwise monetizing the service? It's good that he's been, the Telegram example specifically has been very explicit about why they want to introduce a subscription service, because monetization is otherwise quite difficult for them. They do have ad-funded opportunities, but I'm not sure how much revenue that's generating for them. And they obviously need to find a way to monetize the product because they're wanting to continue to build out new features and so forth. It then makes me think about how really WhatsApp works the way that it does because it's owned by Facebook. So it's up, no two ways about it. It is subsidized, and that's how they can afford to still offer it as a relatively ad-free experience and are not doing things like experimenting with subscription models. Who knows, maybe they'll try in the future. As for Snapchat, I mean, similar thing again, I'm not really their user profile, but those features don't sound that alluring, really. Like, you'd really have to
change the app icon. Come on. That's amazing. And you could label a contact as hashed, like number one BFF.
Yeah.
And you can find out their location history,
which
that's
is amazing.
Another reason for me.
Oh, the young people will love that one. The location.
They will. But will they be paying for it though?
No, their parents will. Their parents will. They're smart people.
So So then I think, you know, that's a really good point, Lisa, is how is that going to be monetized? Like, you know, obviously it'd probably be a pretty affordable price point, and you're right, kids will make their parents pay for it. But then you're stuck with the same model, which is, yes, okay, you've perhaps launched a subscription service, but it's only ever going to tap out at a certain amount of revenue, and you are still going to be largely relying on ad-funded revenue to sustain your business. And I don't actually think there's anything wrong with that.
No, Lisa, what do you think? I mean, do you feel that paid tiers are the future of the industry, and can companies rely on their users to kind of keep paying additional subscriptions, especially in the tough times that we're facing into and have been living through?
Yeah, look, I agree with most of Rachel's points completely. And what I think these companies have to do is produce something outstanding for us to be willing to part with our money, because otherwise we just aren't willing to do it. There's too many services free that are on offer. And okay, you know, WhatsApp, Facebook may be playing with people's data, but at the moment we're still not that bothered as a society who steals our data and who uses it. I think the younger generations, there's going to be a whole change, because I think as we move forward, I mean, cybercrime's gone through the roof. So, you know, we do need to start. We're not educating anyone in schools about this, these issues. And it's something that we do need to look at. And it is, our data is very, very important. I have a foster son. It was really interesting when we said to the borough that have cared for him, we would like all information for on his file. And they were like, nobody's asked for that. What do you mean nobody's asked for that? How can they've got all this information, like stacks of it? And it's really interesting. But yeah, I think they need to offer outstanding outstanding content. For example, we signed up for Disney during COVID, during the lockdown, and we ended up getting rid of it because, you know, you've only watched, the kids have watched so many, you've done Movie Night a few times and you've had enough. And I'm afraid that's sort of happening with Netflix, isn't it? You know, I think we've all got really annoyed with them putting up their prices. It's like, guys, you're not producing, okay, if you're going to charge me a few quid extra a month, you've got to be producing some pretty outstanding stuff. And I think that's what's really clever. We do some stuff with the Financial Times, who work with our charity. And that's what's interesting about them. They've really got their niche. They've really got their target market. So they can offer, though, you know, they can charge a certain price. But yeah, I think it has to, if it is going, it can't just be a massive offering. It needs to be a really niche area, and it needs to be a magical thing that they're offering. Otherwise, people just go in and change and remove. Our banking's so brilliant now with you know, certain apps, you just go cancel, or you just go into your phone and you just cancel, you go all the way through, don't you? So actually making that easy as well is very clever of some of them, because the easier that, like, if I really need to watch a Disney film, I'm definitely going to quickly go on there and quickly purchase it. And
exactly, so. Yeah. And I think that's a really good point. I think you're going to see
with
a
your
lot
NFTs
more.
Yeah.
Yep. Of course.
Sorry, Rachel, go ahead.
No, I think you're just going to see a lot more, you know, a lot more pay as you go, basically. You know, consumption of digital content on demand. I want to watch something, I want to watch a film, or I want to watch a particular series, and so I'm just going to pay for that. And that's exactly what I think is happening with more content heavy platforms, social media platforms, and, you know, messaging utility apps. Who's going to pay for those services? It's just, I mean, even if you think about things like Deliveroo, Uber Eats, who's got a premium Deliveroo account? Who's back, what, why, what for? You don't need it. So then I sort of do feel a little bit guilty, because I just think this is also a symptom of us just being so used to getting stuff for free, getting content for free, and actually getting quite good utility functionality for free. And that is where the internet has trained us poorly. But then that's what the advertising industry has supported for many years. So, yeah.
Oh, is this a good time to move on to our third story then? The good old advertising industry, advertising technology industry. We'll see. So, third story, Apple and Google facing further legal trouble. Surprise, surprise.
I was about to say, Kel surprise.
Yeah, exactly. Well, the Wall Street Journal has reported that four senators want the FTC to investigate Apple and Google for collecting and selling their users' data. So the FTC, for listeners, is the Federal Trade Commission, and they've looked to become more stringent on data issues in recent years. And even as Apple claimed to be the leading, or leading the way on user privacy, a letter co-signed by four senators called for further investigations into their practices, as well as Google's. These identifiers have fueled the unregulated data broker market by creating a single piece of information linked to a device that data brokers and their customers can use to link to other data about consumers. This just seems like an old story. You know, it's happening over and over and over again. So what I'm keen to kind of get your thoughts on, ladies, is, and Lisa, I'm going to come to you. What needs to happen for big tech to take lasting action on data privacy?
I think our governments are just shocking, you know, in terms of taking a stand against this. We see consistently young people are exposed to, at the moment, it's a pandemic of them using social media, you know, sharing images, women getting, you know, attacked on Twitter. I mean, I know a number of people who have removed themselves from Twitter because of the trolling. How is this acceptable in a day and age where it can be traced back to your phone or your computer? It's just unrealistic. And it's because our governments, they just don't understand digital. And I think, you know, when the whole thing, what was it, the Facebook, and was it Oxford's? Oh, it was that company, wasn't it?
Cambridge Analytica.
Yeah, it was Cambridge Analytica. And it was really interesting then because the governments were just, you know, completely spinning. I remember like really ridiculous questions when they were in Congress and having a, you know, delving into it. And they just don't realize the power of it. Mm. And it's a very dangerous game because we know that, you know, Facebook has been used literally to change whole governments, you know.
Yeah.
It's not, our governments really do need to come together and work together to change this. And obviously, look, TV had the same, radio had the same, all of them needed to be regulated. And as much as I don't want, you know, I love social media. It's been a phenomenal space for me as a human, my black book, my community, but it is a problem. And if everybody needs a passport to have to use social media to stop them from being racist, you know, attack women, etc., then I think we need to step in. And sharing data is our kids. These are our young people. You know, even I've shared pictures of my children on social, and I'm like, oh, do I close down my account? Because you do, you know, years ago, social used to be really fun and you used to share everything. And that data on somebody, that what people can do with that information is really dangerous. And as I said, like, you know, having a young person and all of that information at this age, we were lucky. We didn't have all of this information being stored on us as teenagers. But it really does scare me because it can come and haunt these young people. You know, we're very passionate with our charity and teaching the young people, your digital footprint is super important. Your data is, you know, don't give it up. It's like having your house and a key, lock it. Mm-hmm. You know? Really do protect it.
Do you find, sorry to jump in there, but do you find, Lisa, that they are, that when you're speaking to young people about that, they're really aware of it and they're tuned into it? Or are you finding they're largely not thinking about it until you point out the potential pitfalls and dangers?
They're not really thinking about it. And when you explain to them that, you know, they could share a tweet that we've seen in the press where people have, you know, got the sack for saying something maybe racist, and they've been, you know, taken from the TV show that they dreamt of landing. And it is a sad situation. And yes, that's the problem. Our schools, the whole government system is so separated from the digital space. It's like this weird, different world. Well, the digital world is our world. You know, we create it, we live in it, it's part of it. Social media is what we do as human beings. We are social. But it's really interesting. It's so detached. And it's not the school's fault, but it's a massive problem in terms of skills. Our young people aren't getting digital skills, but they're not getting the digital protection. You know, there's bits and bobs, but this is essential. This is like, you know, as central as maths, English. It's what we live and breathe now. Digital is not just something that you've got to maybe have. Digital is what we do with everything we do in a daily life now. You know, all of our government documentation's online, getting your MOT, your CAT, everything we do. is online. And that information that we're putting into these companies that are holding our information, they need to be held accountable. It's not acceptable to be selling our data. Or if they are going to sell our data, at least go and build some decent schools and some decent, you know, some decent stuff for people instead of buying, like, you know, more mega yachts. Like, come on.
But don't, am I correct in thinking that the government gave Google access to our health records, and in return, Google are, I don't know, building a hospital somewhere, or they were certainly doing something in Finland. I don't know if they're doing it here. That sounds about right. Take the UK data and build a great hospital in Finland.
It does sound about right. Make things even better in Scandinavia and just don't worry
exactly.
about things over here.
I mean, I'd love to know for listeners out there, you know, to get in touch and kind of give best case examples of educational systems that are making a difference and governments that are making a difference, because this conversation is quite UK centric because it's what we're familiar with and what we're living with. But I really hope that there are some other countries out there that are proactively making a change, and that would be something that we could learn from, ideally. And it's not kind of, it's the power of the people, right? And I really can't go down this road because I just think about our government and I just can't get into politics. And my head in my hands right now, listeners. But so anyway, Rachel, what do you think? Are Apple leading the way, or just kind of paying lip service to user privacy? And then, of course, Apple users are 80% more wealthy than the rest of the people in the world. But anyway, I'll try and not
I feel we're spiraling into dark rabbit holes this afternoon. So I've got a couple of thoughts on this. Firstly, this particular story, obviously, specifically about what both Apple and Google have done with mobile identifiers. And I do think these complaints are completely legitimate, and the US government and lawmakers should be going after them very forcefully, because what they have done is created an environment where explicit user consent is required. But it's had the converse effect of keeping people locked into those ecosystems, and they haven't made it easy for people to not consent. And so that's wrong. We know that's wrong. You need to be offering people the explicit opportunity to opt out, or that needs to be the default option. That's certainly what happens in a lot of digital marketplaces, digital environments in the European Union, because they're very strong, the European Union legislators on how to handle data privacy. Mm. But it goes well beyond this. This is just a specific example, right, of how big organizations and companies like Google and Facebook have arguably wielded their power to either circumvent data privacy laws and or create and strengthen their own marketplaces where they can do what they like with people's data. So what goes hand in hand with that is everything that Lisa just mentioned, which is an awareness and understanding of your digital identity and a digital footprint. And you're absolutely right, Lisa, that needs to start at a, you know, grassroots educational level. We need to be educating children about it. And we need to be, as a society, taking a lot more collective responsibility for that. Then in addition to that is the third tier, which is that governments 100% need to step up. And in order to do that, they also need to educate themselves and need to bring themselves into, you know, the 2020s, shall we say, and get some expertise and understanding about what it is they're trying to legislate and control. Interestingly, because this particular piece of legal action is and complaint is being brought forward in the US, it reminded me of something that we mentioned at ATS London, which is that the piece of legislation going through Congress at the moment called the Competition and Transparency in Digital Advertising Act. And that is actually aimed at destroying, if you like, the competitive stranglehold that that companies like Google specifically and other ad tech companies, large ad tech companies and media owners have in terms of owning and operating an advertising technology stack. Now, that might sound really, you know, kind of technically specific to advertising technology, but it's a very interesting piece of legislation because it's all hooked on anti-competition. And if it goes through Congress and if it's passed, because it's also a federal piece of legislation, it will mean that companies like Google will have to break up the advertising technology stack. They can't own it and operate it. They have to actually create some distance. And so they'll either sell part of it off or they'll create different entities and different companies. But it will change the way they have to operate. And the more legislation that does that, that actually gets in the way of these companies companies feeling like they can just do what they want whenever they like and very little consequences lay at their feet, then the better. That's the only thing that I think, well, not the only thing, it's one of the main things that I think will actually make a difference. So it's not just about coming up with that legislation, but it's about designing it so that it gets in, so that it reaches these companies at their core. So it's not just individual specific complaints about or specific lawsuits about one element or another of their activity, but it's actually changing the way fundamentally they operate. And then needs to obviously be a enforcement layer on top of that. The problem that we've got at the moment with data privacy complaints is that when, depending on what the particular complaint is and which jurisdiction it's brought forward in, the consequences don't seem to be grave enough for these companies to change the way that they're acting and operating, right? They get slapped with a fine, which to the average person seems like a lot of money, and actually it's peanuts for these big organizations and corporations. So there needs to be a lot of change to the way that we're legislating what these companies are doing. And this is a good start, but like I said, it needs to be underpinned by that much more fundamental legislation. And everything that we've all just raised, I think, is critically important. This has gone on for too long. We have to be taking some collective responsibility, both as citizens and also as elected leaders and lawmakers and legislators. It's just ridiculous.
So how are we going to do it? And I'm keen. I mean, Lisa, I know that you're very active for making change, and this is hopefully a good opportunity for you to start telling us a little bit more about what you do on a day-to-day basis.
Yeah. So DigiLearning, we are a UK registered charity. We have, most of our young people are from the UK, but we also have young people from Barbados, Jamaica, the USA, Nigeria, Namibia, all over the world. And we have two virtual key accelerator programs that we run twice a year. Girl Rise in March, DigiRise in October, and our young people go on a journey, three levels. First level, self-development. And first, that self-development level, that's where we talk about their digital footprint, you know, their digital reputation, how to start building that and how to start protecting that and how to keep safe as well. And then we move through, about business, and we work with Financial Times, so they come in and do sessions, as well as TikTok and other organisations. And then we offer them jobs at the end of it. But our kids, they are savvy. They're very digital, you know, they're digital natives, but they do need protection and they do need to understand how important it's like. So many that none of them have got a LinkedIn profile. I don't know what these schools are doing, but you know, it's really pretty basic. All the kids do need a LinkedIn profile. Just understanding as well how damaging it can be on their reputation and how amazing it can be if they use it in the right way. You know, I grew up in extreme poverty, bottom of the pile, and I was very lucky with social media to give me the tools to be able to build that black book, to be able to build my reputation as a social media expert. It was about 13 years ago when it wasn't all the big agencies talking about or doing social media. Actually, it's interesting because that's now come around, and social media is quite important, which is me and Tamara Littleton from Social Element were discussing. It was like, it's perks now. They're actually, not putting the intern on social media. Mm. And it's really, and if we think about how society has treated social media or even business, and then you look at, the way the world is, you think, no wonder we're in the problems we are. If we can't realise how powerful social media is, and we're letting our children, our young people use these tools without having guidance, because most of us don't realise that there's an issue because it's accelerated at such a fast.
We're not even on the right place at the right, there's all other places. But it seems to come back down to education and the government again, how these kids aren't being taught properly at school, the tools aren't there. So therefore, what's happening at the kind of university or third level education level where the teachers are being trained, and what's happening for those practitioners that are kind of caught in between, that they're experienced at such a level, but it's taken them time to get to that level. So therefore they're disconnected to what's going on in the world, and they're responsible for making decisions. It's just, it's a bit bonkers, but how can we change it? What, the acting industry is quite powerful. What can we be doing in addition to what you're trying to do, which is phenomenal, but it's a numbers game, right? We need more and more people to get behind it. And I know, you know, I noticed recently that you were grateful to be out in Cannes. You haven't taken it for granted, and it was an amazing experience. But, you know, you want to bring some of the kids in your charity out there. Yeah. And, you know, there was a call to action. I'd love to know what type of people responded and how they're responding, or what we could do as a platform to try and champion the world of ad tech and martech to get behind that.
Yeah, well, that's it. Look, it's about it. Life is about experiences. And the more we experience, the more that opens our minds. And I remember I had an internship, didn't last long because I was way too busy partying at Sony when I was at university. But it went on my CV and it got me into doors. And that's what it's about. It's about cool experiences. So I have had quite a few amazing individuals step up and say they would like to support. So we're looking at how many take, what days they could do where, because, you know, we can set them some really cool creative briefs and get them creating, you know, good content. And also, we all know that, you know, going to like the female quotient, the Google Beach, the Facebook Beach, it's all brilliant experiences. The panels there are phenomenal. And also, like next week, we've got the kids taking part in Madfest. Now, they're getting split into two teams and they're delivering on a brief. Now, as a young person, to be able to do that is such an experience. And also, what's brilliant, last year, Nat West got so much from it. They were blown away that they got our kids to then repeat their pitches to the C-suite online and paid them, because they were like, they saved them a ton of money. They were creating a Gen Z product and had not actually got a lot of feedback from Gen Z. Our Gen Z gave them really direct feedback, really, really, you know, detailed and specific on how they could improve their product. And they did. So it's a win-win. We need to find the superheroes of today, because we're losing them. And our industry, as we know, hasn't got like the football industry and the sports industry, these scouts that go and look for young people. So we're doing that. We need more support in terms of experiences. Work experience is really important as well. And people, please remember, if you are going to give work experience, remember these young people come from poverty. So you may think that £10 isn't a lot, but it is a lot. You know, if they do a week work experience, that's, you know, say £80 in just travel, they haven't got it. You know, for a household that lives in extreme poverty, it's not a joke. You know, I experienced it as a young person, and it's really, really hard. That money is essential for a household. So please consider that. So maybe buy them a ticket in advance, you know, just be a bit more thoughtful. And these young people do need nurturing. So we need mentors, workshops. Obviously, money's great as well, because we want to do more detailed boot camps as well. So throughout the summer, we want to do more specific boot camps. So like one around ad tech, you know, and then present them with a load of opportunities. And it's amazing, because we have got phenomenal companies employing our young people, like Julia Smith, the Digital Voice, 59A. Like they're, you know, they took the risk and now they're like, can you bring us more young people?
It's paying off. Yeah, which is great, right? Yeah,
it's brilliant. Yeah. Really,
I mean, I think, you know, a lot of what you've just talked about there, Lisa, and what you're focusing on, what your charity is focusing on, is just so important, because we wind up talking quite a bit at ExchangeWire about the next generation of ad tech execs, right? So there'll be people that are already well into their career, but what about the people that are junior to them and the people that are really just starting out in their career? What type of experience are they getting in the ad tech and marketing tech industry? And, you know, you want that experience to be good, because what you want to attract great talent, and the way that you get great talent into a business is to look for it in every corner in society, right? You don't just want, you know, a staffed team in a business and an organization full of, you know, people that are all the same. You need to introduce some diversity of thought and experience and preferences. And that's where things really start to get interesting and engaging. And, you know, there's a lot of research and evidence to suggest that that's actually hugely profitable for most businesses, no matter how traditional your business might be, or how sort of, you know, I suppose, how contained and controlled your business or your vertical might be. At the end of the day, the more people that you've got working in your company from all sorts of different backgrounds and with different experience, the better off you'll be. So, yeah, we find ourselves talking about that a lot. And I just think that it's great that businesses and organisations in the industry are being encouraged to think about this, are being encouraged to proactively go out there and look for offer internships, think about the types of internships that they're offering. When we've had a couple of interns work at Exchange Wire, we've been in the fortunate position where we've been able to offer them some kind of payment for their internship, because that's what we want to do. We want them to understand that that's what work is. I mean, I know people, you know, in a basic context understand that's what work is, but I don't know. I'm of a generation when the very first job that I got, you know, it was all by trial, right? So you work for free for a bit. I mean, what is that? Yeah. And, you know, I'd like to see the end of that, right? Like, I'd like to see the end of us just treating young people like people that we can take advantage of. You know, ultimately, I think people should be paid for the efforts that they contribute. And so, yeah, so I'm just hugely supportive of what you're doing, Lisa. I think it's great. And I'd encourage lots of organisations and companies getting in touch with you and finding out more, because this is how we're going to be, inspiring the next generation of amazing advertising and marketing professionals.
Totally. It's very exciting as well. You know, we're going to find the superheroes of the future and of today. And yeah, like you said, it makes sense for an organization. Their profitability goes up, innovation goes up. It is. It's about diversity in every which we learn from each other. And that's how we progress, and that's how we do better. So yeah, it's exciting. And there's also some other phenomenal people that are organizations that are working with young people as well, like the Brixton Finishing School, who are brilliant, the Marketing Academy Foundation, who I'm a trustee with, who hold apprenticeships who are phenomenal, the School of Marketing. And we're looking at ways how we can do more collaboration together, because there's a lot of work that needs doing and there's a huge industry that needs to step up. So, but it's exciting times, really exciting.
That's brilliant. Sadly, that's all we've got time for today, but it's been great having you on board, Lisa. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks, ladies.
Not at all. And Rachel, thank you as always. That's it. That's the Ad Tech Podcast. Thank you for listening.